All right, welcome to session number 14 of our study of Revelation. We're in Revelation 13, chapter 13, and tonight we'll be taking a look at the closer look at the second beast. We got into a little bit of that last week, discussing some of the symbolism and tying that beast in a very loose way to the papacy, and we'll get more into detail about that this evening. As I mentioned last week, one of the complications of studying this part of Revelation is we're not only studying Revelation 13, but we're also taking into consideration 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 and Daniel chapter 7. So there's a lot of detail that we have to sort of synthesize and bring all together as we try to unlock what this symbolism means. And that's going to continue to be the case this evening as we look more closely at the Bishop of Rome, the papacy, and consider how God foresaw the rise of this office and all it would mean to the world. Let's go back though for a moment and just do a quick review of what we talked about last week. We wrapped up the first beast, which I think culminates with the Church of Rome, the Catholic Church, the Latin Church. And what we noticed is that the Catholic Church corrupted God's design. And in doing so, the Latin Church blasphemed God, they blasphemed his church, and they blasphemed those who were martyred for their faith in Jesus. We talked about the cult of the martyrs that eventually developed into the cult of the saints and how that piece of symbolism ties together with that. We also saw last week that the Latin Church in the Middle Ages leaned heavily on secular authorities to root out heresy. Anyone who would not submit to the Catholic Church's authority was put to death, ultimately put to death. Although I will say, and we'll talk about this more next week when we get into the Inquisition, but I will say that their real objective was to get people to convert to Catholicism. So they would actually spend a lot of time trying to coerce their conversion through torture and through ostracizing people from society in order to put pressure on people to come around to see the light, so to speak. But ultimately, there were people that lost their lives because they weren't willing to recant. They weren't willing to be marked with the mark of the beast. And we'll get into some of that probably next week. Another part of Revelation 13, and I think this is really the reason why this particular symbolism is placed in the book. There are both explicit and implied warnings to the church. And we as the church need to heed these warnings. And should we come at a time where this beast perhaps grows more in influence and power, we shouldn't be deceived into thinking that it's something different than what it is. And that warning, I think, remains intact. Of course, it directly applied to those people who were living under the power of the beast during the Middle Ages. And they were really the ones who were suffering. But those warnings, I think, continue to apply to us today. And then as we got into toward the end of last week's study, how the papacy worked together with the Church of Rome, the Latin Church, the Catholic Church, to accomplish its objective. So you have two beasts that are sort of working hand in hand. They complement one another and they work together in order to carry out what I believe is Satan's purpose. So let's get back into chapter 13, verses 11 and 12. We talked about the symbolism of this last week. Let's go ahead and read it. Then we'll review some of that symbolism and then begin to connect in some of the historical record. Then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon. He exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence and causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. So this second beast comes up out of the earth as opposed to the sea. And on the head of this beast are two horns, which we've noticed several different times in both the book of Revelation and the book of Daniel. Horns typically represent kingdoms. So think of it in this way. He has two kingdoms, if you will, coming up out of his head. He has horns like a lamb, but he speaks like a dragon. So he looks like Jesus, but he talks like Satan. And that should make us think about some of the warnings concerning false prophets, in particular the warning that Jesus gave in Matthew chapter 7, verse 15, that there would be false prophets who would come to you as wolves in sheep's clothing. So they look like sheep, but they talk like wolves, if you will. And this imagery, I think, is a play upon that, sort of a recapitulation of that same sort of idea. But rather than a wolf in sheep's clothing, you have a dragon in lamb's clothing in this particular beast. The two horns that represent two kingdoms, I believe, represent the two domains of authority that the papacy claims, or that it has historically claimed. Now, I believe, as I said last week, and as I've stated a couple of times tonight, I believe the second beast represents the papacy, and you'll probably hear me refer to the papacy as the Bishop of Rome. If you hear me say the Bishop of Rome, that's just another title for the papacy. And I'm using the word papacy because we're talking about an office, not necessarily an individual within that office, because quite frankly, there are some popes that have been far more effective than others. There have been long stretches of time where the Catholic Church was led by they weren't very effective leaders. So, but we're talking about an office, and we're talking about an office that claims to have authority in two domains, in two kingdoms, if you will. And the first kingdom is, of course, a spiritual kingdom. So you have one horn that represents the spiritual authority of the papacy. But then you have a second horn, and this is one that we often overlook, but it's very much in play even in today's world. And that is a second kingdom, a kingdom of this world. And it symbolizes the territories that this office has ruled and governed as a king. And as I said, that continues to this day. Nestled within the city of Rome is a micronation, the Vatican. This is a nation apart from Italy. If you get on the U.S. State Department website, you can read about our diplomatic relations with the Vatican. The Vatican is its own nation, and it's significantly reduced in size and scope from what it used to be. But make no mistake, the Pope is not only the head of the Catholic Church, but he is also the head of state of a nation here on earth. So there's both a spiritual authority and a secular authority that is claimed by this one office. And I want to take each one of these individually and just talk about how these developed historically, because I think that that's a really interesting examination. So let's talk first about the spiritual authority, how it developed, because this didn't happen overnight. It took a couple of hundred years for this to come into its fullness, so to speak. And we see early signs of this in the fourth century. We've talked quite a lot about Constantine, and I'm going to bring him up several times tonight because he is an important figure in our discussion of Revelation because of what he represents. He represents a moment when the Roman Empire shifted from paganism to Christianity in its orientation. And this begins in 313 with the Edict of Milan. This is when Constantine legalized Christianity throughout the Roman Empire. Prior to that point, Christianity was tolerated, but technically it was an illegal religion. And in fact, you can get a taste of this if you look really closely at Acts chapter 16, when Paul and Silas are accused by some local businessmen of teaching things which are not lawful for Romans to observe. Quite frankly, the Christian religion was something that was tolerated, it was permitted, but its claims made it illegal. With Constantine, though, he legalizes Christianity throughout the Roman Empire. And as we talked about a few weeks ago, with the Council of Nicaea in 325, this was a council that Constantine convened. He called together the luminaries of the 4th century church, and he demanded that they make some decisions, that they reach some agreements. And as a part of that Council of Nicaea, three bishops are elevated above all of the rest. The bishops of Rome, Alexandria, and Antioch are declared at that council to be of superior authority to the rest of the bishops in the church. That's a very important development. And it's especially important thinking about the development of the papacy's spiritual authority. A few years later, in 381, at the First Council of Constantinople, we see the bishopric of Constantinople elevated alongside the first three. So you have now four bishoprics within the 4th century church that are held to be the primary sees of the Christian religion. And this is stated quite plainly in canon number 3. This is part of the declaration that went out as a result of the Council of Constantinople. In canon 3, it is said, the bishop of Constantinople, however, shall have the prerogative of honor after the bishop of Rome, because Constantinople is the new Rome. So even though Constantinople was, in a sense, placed on similar footing as Rome, Antioch, and Alexandria, there's a recognition at the Council of Constantinople that Rome is superior to those other two, and now Constantinople has jumped over Alexandria and Antioch. Now you have four bishoprics that are elevated above the rest, but really two that are sort of co-equal, so to speak. And the Bishop of Constantinople is just a little bit behind the Bishop of Rome. This establishes a rivalry between these two bishoprics that lasts for about 700 years. And the Bishop of Rome, of course, claimed that his was the primary see in Christendom because Peter founded the Roman Church. He was the first bishop of Rome. He was the rock upon which the church was built. Therefore, the Bishop of Rome should be the preeminent authority within the church. That was the claim. I'm not saying that those things are true. But the Bishop of Constantinople thought, well, my city is the capital of the Roman Empire. Rome is now just a backwater town. I really need to be on equal footing with the Bishop of Rome. So you've got this rivalry that begins to develop between those two. This leads us to the Council of Chalcedon in 451. And I promise I'm going to give you a whole lot more about this, but these councils are really important. They show us a gradual evolution in the power of the papacy. In canon 28 of this council places the Bishop of Constantinople on equal footing with the Bishop of Rome. And basically what the Council of Chalcedon did is it went back to the first Council of Constantinople, which happened about 70 years before that. And it basically said, well, Constantinople was placed alongside these other three bishoprics, but in reality, it's equal to the Bishop of Rome. And this is what they said. The First Council of Constantinople, actuated by the same consideration, gave equal privileges to the Most Holy Throne of New Rome, justly judging that the city which is honored with the sovereignty and the Senate and enjoys equal privileges with the old imperial Rome, should in ecclesiastical matters also be magnified as she is and rank next after her. So you have just this gradual rivalry developing between these two ecclesiastical sees. And Pope Leo I, who was the Bishop of Rome at the time, he acknowledged the authority of the Council of Chalcedon, but he rejected this particular canon because he saw Constantinople growing in its prominence, and he saw a threat to his power. And just incidentally, if you remember, Pope Leo I, who's also known as Pope Leo the Great, this is the man who, when Attila the Hun had surrounded the city of Rome, went out and negotiated with Attila to not sack the city and to basically go away. So he's quite an example of this growing power. All right, a little bit later on in the 5th century, in 495, a synod of bishops declares Pope Delasius to be the vicar of Christ. That might be something that you've heard before, this term, the vicar of Christ. And basically what that means is he is Christ's substitute on earth, that since Jesus is in heaven, the bishop of Rome is now a stand-in for Jesus, so to speak, that when he speaks with the authority of Jesus Christ. Now, this is a term that is first stated in 495, and it sort of goes in and out of usage for a few hundred years, but it's when Pope Innocent III comes to the throne of Rome that it becomes one of the main titles of the Bishop of Rome. He becomes known from that point forward, really for all time, to be the Vicar of Christ. Then about 25 years later, we have another important development in all of this. We have what's known as the formula of Pope Hormisdas. And this is a very important document. And if you do a little bit of research into this, what you begin to discover is this is a document that probably none of us have ever heard of, maybe prior to this point. But it's a very important document in the dispute between the Greek church in the East and the Latin church in the West. Because there was always this tug of war between Constantinople and Rome, between the church of the East and the church of the West. And the bishops in the East did not want to be subject to the bishop of Rome in the West. So you have a schism called the Acacian Schism that has developed. There's ongoing strife. So what Pope Hormisdas does is he drafts a letter. He drafts a statement of faith, and he demands that the Emperor Justinian and all of the Eastern bishops sign this formula of Pope Hormisdas. And I have an excerpt of it on the next slide. This is what it said. Now, they were to sign this, saying that they agreed with the statement. The first condition of salvation is to preserve the standard of true faith and not to forsake the tradition of the fathers. The saying of Christ, "Thou art Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church." That should be "my," not "by." "I will build my church," cannot be annulled. These words have been verified. For the Apostolic See, that means the Bishop of Rome, has always preserved untainted the Catholic religion. By following in every respect the Apostolic See, by teaching what it has already established, we hope to abide with you in the sole communion which the Apostolic See proclaims, and listen to this last part, in which verily is to be found all the power of the Christian religion. This is an astounding statement. What the papacy, what Pope Hormisdas is claiming in this document is that Peter founded the church in Rome. He was its first bishop. And because Peter is the rock and he was the first bishop of Rome, the papacy claims to be the preeminent bishopric in all of the church, in all of Christendom. And the papacy claims in that latter part of the quotation to possess all the power of the Christian religion. Now, this is what I mean by this little horn representing, or I shouldn't say little horn, this horn that represents its spiritual authority. It's taken a couple of hundred years to get to this point, but this is another example of the papacy gradually exerting its influence and establishing its supremacy over Christendom. This leads us to the next most important emperor after Constantine in the Eastern Roman Empire, and that's an emperor by the name of Justinian. Justinian is probably the greatest emperor after Constantine in the East. And Justinian does a couple of things to further the claims of the Bishop of Rome. One interesting thing that he does in 531 is he creates what's called the Pentarchy, five bishoprics that he identifies as patriarchs. These are the bishoprics of Rome, Constantinople, Alexandria, Antioch, and notice that he adds in Jerusalem. Now, four of these have already been stated to be four bishoprics that were above all the others, but now Jerusalem has been lumped in with the other four. But a couple of years later, Justinian makes it clear that of these five, there is one that is greatest. In a letter to Pope John on March 15th, 533, he writes this: "Yielding honor to the Apostolic See and to your holiness," and again, Apostolic See is just another way of saying the Bishopric of Rome. "Yielding honor to the Apostolic See and to your holiness, and honoring your holiness as one ought to honor a father, we have hastened to subject all the priests of the whole Eastern district and to unite them to the See of your holiness, for we do not allow it of any point, however manifest and indisputable it be, which relates to the state of the churches, not being brought to the cognizance of your holiness, since you are the head." You are the head of all the holy churches. So Justinian comes right out and says, look, I'm acknowledging and I've commanded all of the Eastern bishops to acknowledge that you, the Pope of Rome, you are the head of all the churches. This is a significant moment. 533, an emperor of the Eastern Roman Empire declares that the Bishop of Rome is the supreme authority of Christ's church here upon earth. And that's the reason why I believe that first horn represents the papacy's spiritual authority. But there's a second horn, and that represents what you could call his secular authority, or perhaps you might call his civil authority, that he rules not just as a king in God's church, but also as a king in this world. And again, I want to take us back to some things that we've talked about in the past and bring out a couple of new facts that I think might help us see this picture a little bit more fully. So the city of Rome from 330 to 476 was not the same city that existed before. You might remember in 330, Constantine moved the capital of the Roman Empire to the east, to this new city of Constantinople. And what that did is it created a power vacuum within the city of Rome. The power of the Western Roman emperors was reduced. You've got the main seat of government in the east. The west has been reduced to more of a subject nation, so to speak. And as the power of the Western emperors dwindled, the papacy stepped into the vacuum. In fact, at one point in 402, as those Germanic barbarian tribes from over to the east are beginning to work their way to the west and begin invading the territories of Rome, Emperor Honorius moved the capital of the Western Roman Empire from Rome to Ravenna. So the capital of Rome, the Western Roman Empire, wasn't even in Rome from 402 to 476. It was actually in the city of Ravenna, and he moved it there because he felt like that was a safer place for him and his successors. But when he moved to Ravenna, that made the Bishop of Rome the most powerful man in the city of Rome. And this again takes me back to what Paul prophesies in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 6 and 7. And I think I've mentioned this passage a couple of different times, but I want to come back to it again. And now you know what is restraining, that he may be revealed in his own time. For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. Only he who now restrains will do so until he is taken out of the way. The thing that was restraining this apostasy, this mystery of lawlessness, this man of perdition from appearing, was the power of the Roman Empire. But as the Western Roman emperors lost their authority, as they dwindled in their power, as they moved the capital of the West from Rome to Ravenna, what restrained the Bishop of Rome was taking it out of the way. So as Rome became friendly to Christianity, as the power in the West began to dwindle, this opened up an opportunity for the papacy, the power of the papacy, to grow. Myers, in his Ancient History, talks about this. This is a rather lengthy quotation, but this is what he observes. Again, when the barbarians came, there came another occasion for the Roman bishops to widen their influence and enhance their authority. Rome's extremity was their opportunity. Basically, what he means by that is Rome was up against the wall, and this was an opportunity for the papacy to expand its authority. Thus, it will be recalled how mainly through the intercession of the pious Pope Leo the Great, the fierce Attila the Hun was persuaded to turn back and spare the imperial city. Thus, when the emperors, the natural defenders of the capital, were unable to protect it, the unarmed pastor was able, through the awe and reverence inspired by his holy office, to render services that could not but result in bringing increased honor and dignity to the Roman see. So here's Pope Leo the Great again. This is the same man who disputed that Canon 28 in the Council of Chalcedon, which basically put the Bishop of Constantinople on nearly equal footing with the Bishop of Rome. This same Pope Leo was able to act as a delegate on behalf of the city, as an ambassador to negotiate with a foreign invader and convince that foreign invader to leave the city alone. So we see the papacy beginning to assume more and more authority in the secular realm. He's negotiating with a hostile army on behalf of the city. This really, though, begins to gain steam with Pope Gregory the Great, who was ruling in the latter part of the 6th century. When Pope Gregory came to the throne, at that point, the church was the largest landowner in Western Europe. The church had this territory directly around the city of Rome that was called the Patrimony of Peter. But it also had estates scattered all throughout Western Europe. And it had a few areas in North Africa, and all of these estates belonged to the church, and all the taxes and proceeds from that estates that flowed into the coffers of Rome. Gregory used the proceeds from these estates basically to finance the defense of Rome and Naples. So he's taking money coming from these estates into the coffers of the church, and he's paying for military protection, for military defense of Rome and Naples. So you see this growth of the secular authority. Gregory also significantly increased the church's bureaucracy. And Norwich, in his book Absolute Monarchs, which is a book about the papacy that came out about 10 years ago, he observed this about Gregory. He said he formed a civil service unparalleled in Europe outside of Constantinople itself. Basically, Gregory was building up the bureaucracy of the church so that it looked more like a kingdom of this world rather than the kingdom of heaven. Langer, in his Encyclopedia of World History, had this to say about Gregory. Gregory boldly assumed the role of the emperor in the West and the powers of a temporal prince counterbalancing the prestige of Constantinople. From his administration date the foundations of later claims to papal absolutism. Gregory was the real leader against the Lombards, appointing governors of cities, directing the generals in war, and receiving from Constantinople pay for the army. That term, papal absolutism, is an important term. That is the doctrine, the belief, that the Bishop of Rome was the highest power in the world. And by highest power, I mean not just in the church, but the highest secular authority as well. And Pope Gregory laid the foundation for later claims of papal absolutism. And as you notice in that quotation, what's Pope Gregory doing? He's appointing governors. He's directing generals in war. He's receiving from Constantinople pay for the army. So he's basically a king. He's basically a prince. He's acting like a secular authority. Fast forward about 150 years and we come to what's known as the donation of Pepin. This is Pepin the Short. You've probably heard the name Charlemagne. Charlemagne was one of the sons of Pepin the Short. And Pepin the Short is important in this particular part of the papacy's development because Pepin the Short turned the papacy into an earthly kingdom, so to speak. In the 8th century, Rome begins to turn away from Byzantium. Byzantium's that Eastern Roman Empire, and the popes are very frustrated with the way things are going. They're being taxed. The emperors in the East had outlawed images and statues. It's a doctrine known as iconoclasm. Constantinople would not protect Rome from the Lombards, who were always attacking these Christian territories. And so Pope Stephen II appealed to Pepin the Short, and he asks Pepin the Short to come down and protect him and the territories faithful to the Catholic Church, to protect these territories from the Lombards. Now, what's interesting about Stephen II is he was the first Latin pope since 685. His 12 predecessors were Greek. So he's the first Latin pope. And he does something very interesting. He anoints Pepin and his two sons, patricians of Rome. This is a title that he completely made up. And we'll get into this more next week, but the papacy had no problem making things up if it suited its needs. And we'll talk about more in more detail about that next week when we get into the Holy Roman Empire, which was basically a creation of Pope Leo III and Charlemagne, something that they created completely out of whole cloth, and it was neither holy nor Roman. So basically, he just creates this title, Patrician of the Romans, and Patrician, these were the traditional nobility of Rome, and these were the class from which emperors were eventually taken by the Roman Empire hundreds of years before this. Anyways, so Pope Stephen gives Pepin this title, this made-up title, and he makes Pepin the Short basically the defender of the papacy. And Pepin defeats the Lombards, and he donates to the papacy territories in central Italy, thus creating what later becomes known as the Papal States. And it's at this moment when the Papal States are given to Pope Stephen that popes become temporal sovereigns, endowed with judicial titles, and in certain extreme cases, their right was recognized even to dispose of thrones. That's from Legard's History of the Latin Church in the Middle Ages. And what Legard is highlighting there is we no longer have a man who's just the head of the church on earth. Now we have someone who is, in very real terms, a king and a prince of this world. So we have these two horns, these two kingdoms, these two powers, these two domains of power that are at work in this single office. Just to give you a little idea of what the Papal States look like. The yellow part down there was what they were like until about 1178. Then the red part was added in 1178, and then the red part was added in, I can't read my own slide here, but those were gradually added. We'll just go with that. I need glasses here. So anyways, by the end of the 1300s, this was what was known as the Papal State. So you can see they basically take up all of central Italy. And papal sovereignty over this territory lasted from 756, from the donation of Pepin, all the way till 1870. 1,100 years it had rule over this territory. Now, this territory was reduced following the Reformation. It reached its greatest extent in the early 1500s, just before the Reformation hit. And once the Reformation started, these territories began to get gradually picked off and reduced. But what I think is interesting about this is, if you go back to Daniel chapter 7, you might recall in Daniel chapter 7, you've got this beast, and on this beast is 10 horns, but there's this little horn that crops up amidst the 10 horns. I was considering the horns, and there was another horn, a little one coming up among them. The 10 horns are 10 kings who shall arise from this kingdom, and another shall rise after them. This is what's often known as the little horn. Now, we've talked about these 10 horns quite a lot. These are the Germanic tribes that rule the territories of the Western Roman Empire. They eventually become the powers of Europe. But the little horn, this represents the papacy, specifically the papal states with the papacy as the king. So you have a little horn, a small territory in comparison to the other kingdoms, but this little horn appears greater than his fellows. So he's a king, he has a kingdom, but there's something about him that makes him appear greater than his fellows. And what is it that gives him that sense of greatness? Well, it's that spiritual authority, right? He has that air of divine ordination, like he is from God, so to speak. And notice that Daniel says that this little horn arose after them. So by the 8th century, when Pepin the Short gives the papal states, or what later becomes known as the papal state, to the Republic of St. Peter, as it's sometimes called, when he gives that to the Pope, that's happening after these other kingdoms in Western Europe have basically been established. So he comes to this position after the rest of those kingdoms. Now let's get back into the imagery here, back in Revelation 13, and let's talk about why this beast looks like a lamb but talks like a dragon. It's good to remind ourselves that the dragon is the one who's behind all of this. And of course, the dragon represents Satan. He's behind both of these beasts in Revelation 13. Both of these, both the dragon and the first beast have 7 heads and 10 horns. In chapter 13, verse 4, the dragon gives the first beast authority. The second beast speaks like a dragon. And then something is said about the second beast that I think is worth giving some consideration. In verse 14, the second beast performed signs, and he was granted the authority to do these things. Who gave him the authority? Who granted him this authority? Well, I think we could say the dragon granted him that authority. He was also granted power to give breath to the image. Again, granted by who? Well, granted by the dragon. The dragon is the one who's empowering both beasts. And this takes me back to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Verses 3 and 4, this is talking about the apostasy and the son of perdition. And if I haven't stated it clearly, I'll state it clearly right now. I believe the son of perdition is the same as the second beast, is the same as the little horn. This represents the papacy. Let no one deceive you by any means. For that day, and Paul's talking about the return of Jesus, that day will not come unless the falling away comes first. So there's going to be a falling away that precedes the return of Jesus Christ. And the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he sets his God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. The coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan with all power, signs, and lying wonders. I skipped a few verses down to verse number 9. So Jesus won't return until two things happen. He won't return until there's been an apostasy and until the man of sin is revealed. And this man of sin opposes God. And that's what we see happening in the first and second beasts in Revelation 13. They make war against the saints. They oppose those who won't receive the mark of the beast. And we also see in this man of sin that he exalts himself above all that is created or called God or that is worshipped. And that's certainly something we see happening with the papacy. And remember, we're talking about a beast that looks like a lamb but talks like a dragon. Let's always keep that in mind. So it looks like Jesus, but it's talking like Satan. How does this man sit as God in the temple of God showing that he is God? Well, again, I want to do a little backtracking and connect together some ideas here that I think might help us. So I want to think back for a moment to trumpet number 6. So this is back, I don't know, however long ago that was now. I think that was back in February. We were talking about trumpet 6. And I mentioned in trumpet 6 a very important event that happens in 1054. It's known as the Great Schism. This is when the Church of the East, what we call the Orthodox Church, broke away from the Catholic Church. And let me tell you how that happened. This is quite a story. So there's been this rivalry that's been developing between the East and the West for hundreds of years, right? And they just can't agree on doctrine. They're always fighting. There's always stuff going on. Well, finally, one of these popes just gets tired of the whole thing. So he sends an emissary to Constantinople. And his emissary walks into the Hagia Sophia, which is like, that is the greatest temple in Constantinople. It's now a Muslim mosque, but it was an incredible temple. He walks in the middle of a mass while they're serving the Eucharist, which is another word for communion. And he walks up to the front of the church, and he doesn't bow down to the altar, which this immediately would have been a signal to the audience that something was afoot, because every priest who approaches the altar bows down. This man did not. This man was a cardinal, by the way. He walks up to the front, and he pulls out a letter. And in that letter, he excommunicates the Patriarch of Constantinople, the Bishop of Constantinople, and everyone who follows him, and says, if you follow him, you're all going to hell. Said in a lot longer, I'm summing it up, right? He takes the letter, he sets it down on the altar, walks to the back of the church, takes his sandals off, shakes the dirt off of his sandals, puts them back on, says something condemnatory toward the audience, and walks out. That sounds like a mafia hit to me, is what it sounds like. What a thug, right? But that's the kind of power these men were claiming to wield. It's really something. So at that point, you know, these two branches of Christendom go their separate ways. And there's been no healing of that breach ever since. And you can get online and you can kind of read about all the debates and the history of that. It's quite something. Anyway, so you've got this that happens in 1054. Then you might remember from trumpet number 6, in 1057, the Seljuk Turks cross the Euphrates River. And that begins this time period that lasts for about 400 years, which ultimately culminates in the fall of Constantinople in about 1453. In 1071, Byzantium, the Eastern Roman Empire, is defeated by the Seljuk Turks at a very significant battle called Manzikert. And basically, from that point forward, the Eastern Roman Empire, Byzantium, it's about to collapse. And in 1095, the emperor of the Eastern Roman Empire begs Pope Urban II to send help. Because if help was not sent, Byzantium was going to collapse. Just pretty clear. So desperate times call for desperate measures. So they were willing, the emperor was willing to look aside or look beyond this little schism if it meant that he could be rescued from this situation. So Pope Urban II speaks at a council in Clermont. And this has been called the most important speech of the Middle Ages. Because in this speech, he calls for the first of several crusades to rescue Palestine from Muslim powers. And it also signals the end of the Dark Ages in Western Europe. I've got a little bit of the speech here, and I'd like to read it for you this evening. And then, again, this is going back to the whole idea of a lamb who speaks like a dragon. Skip the slide. Oh, you guys can see it. There we go. Most beloved brethren, urged by necessity, I, Urban, by the permission of God, chief bishop and prelate over the whole world, have come into these parts as an ambassador with a divine admonition to you, the servants of God. On this account, I, or rather the Lord, beseech you as Christ's heralds to publish this everywhere and to persuade all people of whatever rank, soldiers and knights, poor and rich, to carry aid promptly to those Christians and to destroy that vile race from the lands of our friends. I say this to those who are present. It meant also for those who are absent. Moreover, Christ commands it. All who die by the way, whether by land or by sea or in battle against the pagans, shall have immediate remission of sins. This I grant them through the power of God with which I am invested. This speech galvanized Western Europe, in particular the Franks, to carry out the First Crusade. And their battle cry during the First Crusade was, God wills it. Let's talk about some of the implications of this speech. You have a man calling to arms the military, the armies of Europe, calling them to arms in the name of Jesus Christ. He does not call them to take the gospel to the followers of Muhammad. No, it's a call to go destroy that vile race. I wanted to be sure I quoted that correctly. He couches it as a command from God. He says Christ commands it. And he offers the forgiveness of sins. Remember what happened when a few friends lowered their paralyzed friend through the roof of a home during the ministry of Jesus? And Jesus forgave the man's sins. What did his critics who were standing close by, what did they say? Who has power to forgive sins but God, right? Who has power to forgive sins but God? Here we have a man who is showing his spiritual and secular authority, putting it on full display. And this is why I think these two beasts blaspheme God, blaspheme his name, blaspheme his church. And if you think back to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, he sits as God in the temple of God. That's exactly what that statement was communicating. Let's tie all this together now with a quote from 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verses 13 through 15. In that passage, Paul says, "For such are false prophets, false apostles, deceitful workers, transforming themselves into apostles of Christ. And no wonder, for Satan himself transforms himself into an angel of light. Therefore, it is no great thing if his ministers also transform themselves into ministers of righteousness, whose end will be according to their works." Jesus warned about wolves in sheep's clothing. John warns us about a lamb who talks like a dragon. And Paul warns us that Satan can be clothed as an angel of light. So it should not surprise us that an office which claims this authority, a appears to be from God, but is in fact backed by the forces of darkness. I am out of time, and I still got about 5 slides left, so we're going to have to save that for next time, I'm afraid. I'll try to get to it next time. Sorry, Randy, we are out of time, my friend. So if anybody's got any questions or comments, hit me up after service tonight. I'll be glad to talk anything over with you. Paul, I saw your hand, so I'll come grab you after service tonight, okay? We've come to that time where we'll extend the gospel invitation. If there's anyone who's ready to become a Christian this evening, we invite you to respond to the gospel call by coming forward, confessing your faith in Jesus Christ, and having your sins washed away in the waters of baptism. Let's stand and sing. Doug?